This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's 10 minutes after the hour of 5 o'clock here in Central Virginia. It's about 51 degrees, and we are under a winter storm watch. Could be a very icy morning. Keep that in mind. You might be a little bit late for work or school, and you can find out if the schools are going to be delayed or closed tomorrow right here on News Radio 1070 WINA. Make sure you tune in early to catch all the news, and we will have the folks tracking that for you early in the morning. And to make sure that you are informed if there is a situation. But we are looking at the possibility of an ice storm tomorrow morning here in Central Virginia. Hey, tomorrow on the program we have my friend Sean Kenny, former Director of Communications for the Republican Party of Virginia. He will join us. We'll also talk with Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville tomorrow. He'll count down the top growth and development stories in Central Virginia of 2008. Very much looking forward to that. Wednesday on this program, author Christopher Lane will join us to discuss his new book, Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness. Fascinating new book, which uses some just released secret documents, which documents the development of shyness as a mental disorder, a social anxiety disorder. Really interesting book. We'll talk about that on Wednesday. Also on Wednesday, Ed Murphy, astronomer from the University of Virginia, will join us to talk about the big space news stories of 2008. Ed Murphy on Wednesday. Tom Hartman joins me on the line. He is the host of the Tom Hartman Program, a nationally syndicated radio program, and you can hear it every afternoon, Monday through Friday, right here in Central Virginia on our sister station, WVAX 1450 AM. Tom, how are you, sir?
Hey, Coy.
Just a second.
Oh.
Close the door. There.
There we go. Hey, that works. I'm good.
Good.
Speaking of space, you sound like you're in space there for a second.
Yes. I had to come in from the cold.
Yeah, there you go. Now, Tom, as we talk to you, where are you exactly?
I'm in, at this very moment, I'm sitting in a houseboat in atop 30 feet of water, about 100 feet from shore in the Willamette River in Portland, Oregon.
Wow. Gosh, I bet that's beautiful. Talk about ice storms. I bet you all get your share out there.
I had to do the show from the house here for a week because we literally couldn't get out. The dock had a foot and a half of snow on it, and there's no rails, and you slip into the river, and you're gone, and it's not good.
Now, where are you from? Are you from the Northwest?
I grew up in Lansing, Michigan.
Okay.
This is the first time in my life I've lived west of the Mississippi other than a summer in San Francisco back in the 60s. But
wow.
This is it.
But you know cold weather then. You grew up with cold weather.
Yeah, we grew up in Michigan. I've lived in Vermont and New Hampshire as well.
So. There you go. Tom Hartman joins me. Honored to have him on the program. Let's get right to it. Let's talk about Barack Obama, soon to be sworn in as our nation's president. And I'd like to hear your thoughts. And Tom, feel free to talk at length. Your thoughts about the upcoming Obama administration vis-a-vis priorities. I'm curious what you would like to see happen in those first 100 days. What needs to happen right away, that ideally, from your perspective where you sit, that Barack Obama should do as soon as he gets into office?
Well, he needs to put together an economic plan that's going to stop us from sliding into the full-blown into the second Republican Great Depression in the last 100 years. The last one arguably got as deep as it did and lasted as long as it did because for 3 years, Herbert Hoover did virtually nothing. And, this time it's only been going on for a little less than a year, really badly. I mean, it's been sliding for some time, but the way that, to a large extent, Franklin Roosevelt got us out of this, you know, the make work programs, the WPA and things like that get a lot of credit. But really, I would say that the major things that helped get us out of the last Republican Great Depression was the creation of a strong social safety net, Social Security, unemployment insurance, a certain kind of minimum welfare program types of programs for people who are out of work, government programs that backstopped the average person. And if Obama wants to pull us out really quickly, a fairly straightforward way to do that and enhance our competitiveness around the world, the competitiveness of our labor force, is to immediately put into place a national health care system so that employers and individuals who don't have employers who are paying for their health insurance no longer have to carry the burden of that cost, and do it in a way that bumps out of the picture these outrageous for-profit healthcare corporations that are skimming typically somewhere between 15% and 25%, in some cases as much as 35% and 40% off the top from our healthcare dollars and sticking them in their pockets. I mean, you have United Healthcare, the second largest health insurance company in the United States, 2 years ago paid their CEO, William McGuire, $1.78 billion. That's $1.78 billion.
You're kidding. Like salary and benefits?
That's right. This is the guy who helped put into place Medicare Part D and United Healthcare, which was pushed very hard by the AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons, because they are principally a front for insurance companies. They make their money on insurance, and they're doing very well from this, thank you very much. And the insurance company that they're writing, that's underwriting all their insurance, is United Healthcare. So that piece of legislation made that company hundreds of billions of dollars, and they rewarded their CEO with over $1 billion in compensation. That's obscene. That's obscene. That's, you know, whereas you look at Medicare, the total overhead cost of Medicare is under 3%. The total cost, which is our single-payer healthcare system in the United States, the total cost of our socialized medicine program in the United States, which is the Veterans Administration, the VA, their total costs are under 3%. When you don't have to pay, you know, 10% to your stockholders in dividends, when you don't have to pay a multi-million or 100 million, or in the case of United Healthcare, $1 billion, you know, payroll and benefits to your CEO and hundreds of millions or billions of dollars to your senior executives, when you don't have corporate jets with gold-plated fixtures in the bathrooms, when you don't have a corporate headquarters and marketing material and advertising and deals like with AARP where you have to split the profits up so there have to be profits, when you strip all that profit-based stuff that comes along with for-profit corporations out, we can deliver health care in the United States for, on average, around 25 to 30% less than we're delivering it right now. The exact same care if we simply got these basically leeches out of the middle. And that's all they are. They're adding nothing to this whatsoever.
Which
they're
is
getting rich.
We're talking with Tom Hartman, a nationally syndicated radio talk show host. You can hear him every afternoon on our sister station, WVAX, 1450 AM. This whole for-profit health care in the history of this country, it's a relatively new thing, right?
Yes, it is. Actually,
under Nixon, I think.
For most of the history of the United States, the belief was that, I mean, people didn't go into medicine to get rich, by and large, and the belief was that health care is part of the commons and it's something that should be provided at, you know, it's a reasonable compensation is fine, but, you know, if doctors weren't multimillionaires back even in the 50s and 60s. And I remember when I was growing up, I was born in 1951. So, as a kid in the 50s and 60s, I remember doctors making house calls to my family. I remember when Blue Cross, I grew up in Michigan, and Blue Cross Blue Shield was required by state law to be a not-for-profit corporation. So there was no skimming off of money for the CEO, no dividends to be paid to stockholders, you know, and the first business that I owned in Michigan, 1973, a company called the Woodley Herbal Company, we sold herbal teas. We had health insurance for all of our employees. I owned the company, and I remember writing the checks. We were paying about $30 a month for health insurance for people.
Oh, my gosh.
$30 a month. And because it was not-for-profit, and every hospital in the state was required by state law to be not-for-profit. So in Lansing, Michigan, we had Sparrow Hospital, which was run by the Catholic Church. We had St. Lawrence Hospital, which was run by the Catholic Church. And we had Ingham Medical, which was run by the county. They were all not-for-profit. Now, all three of those hospitals are for-profit corporations, and you got people like Bill Frist's daddy, who went from merely being a millionaire to being one of the 50 richest men in America, being worth around $7 billion with his company, Healthcare America or whatever it is, by simply buying up these not-for-profit hospitals, flipping them for-profit, cutting everybody's wages, jacking up the prices, and putting the money in his own pocket.
We're talking with Tom Hartman. So realistically then, well, not realistically, ideally, we see some type of health care plan that comes out of the Obama administration in the first year. And, of course, I've read that perhaps Senator Kennedy's health might even move that along, that they would, he would really like to see something passed before he passes away.
Well, and, you know, setting aside sentiment, this is one of the fastest ways to stimulate the U.S. economy because, number one, it's going to put more money in the people in the pockets of working people and small businesses because their health care costs are going to go down. Even if they show up in income taxes and corporate taxes, it's going to be less than what they're paying right now for health care, number one. Number two, you're going to have a healthier workforce. And number three, and perhaps most importantly, you're going to have companies decide to keep their workforce in the United States because it's not going to cost them for health care. You had about 5 years ago was the last time this happened in a big way. Toyota had come to the United States, and they were going to build a plant down in Alabama. They had played three or four states off against each other. Alabama had finally come up with, it was over $150,000 per job created, which is ironic when you figure that, you know, the Republicans wanted to shoot down this bailout of Detroit that was $5,000 per job saved, you know, $15 billion divided by 3 million jobs. But anyhow, it was over $150,000 per job created. They were giving them free land. They were giving them tax abatements. They were going to educate the workforce. They were going to build roads and infrastructure, everything. And at the last minute, Toyota pulled out and built their plant instead in Windsor, Ontario, because they didn't want to have to deal with the health care costs.
It was health care that drove them out.
That's right. And they were right up front about it. And so now you've got some of the largest corporations in America calling for a national health care program simply because they realize that they can't be internationally competitive.
That a national health care program is actually good for business.
That's right. It simply creates a level playing field. Every other industrialized country in the world has one, except us.
Yeah. And it's crippling business, in other words.
That's right.
We're talking with Tom Hartman, host of the Tom Hartman Program. You can hear it on WVAX 1450 AM, Monday through Friday here in Charlottesville from 12 noon to 3 p.m. We're honored to have him on the program. Tom, let me get your thoughts about the Bush administration. He's about to leave Washington, the end to 8 years of his leadership in Washington. Do a postmortem for us, if you can, on the Bush administration.
Well, first, let me say I'm honored to be on your show, Coy.
Well, thank you.
I really appreciate it. And anytime you want me on, I am such a big supporter of local radio, and you do a great job.
Thank you, Tom, very much.
With regard to the Bush administration, I agree with Harry Reid, who over the weekend said that George W. Bush has been the worst president in this nation's history. He has taken more vacation days than any president since George Washington. He was not willing to leave his vacation in order to deal with this crisis in Israel. He was not willing to leave his vacation in August of 2001 when the CIA sent a special officer specifically down to Crawford to hand deliver to him the warning that Osama bin Laden was going to strike the United States in the next 3 months. Bush blew the guy off, patted him on the knee, and said, okay, you've covered your butt. Go back to Washington, D.C. And the guy did. Bush never convened a cabinet meeting, never said, hey, let's find out. You know, in 2000, leading up to the millennia, you know, into January 1st, 2000, late 1999, Bill Clinton, the FBI brought Bill Clinton, or the CIA brought Bill Clinton credible evidence that there was a plot to blow up LAX airport. He convened a cabinet meeting in the White House. He pulled together all the intelligence people. He said, I want to know what's going on. We're going to get this thing. And they nailed that guy when he was trying to come down from Canada to plant that bomb in the airport in LAX. And they stopped a 9/11 that would have happened in January 1st, 2000. George Bush, instead, when he was warned that this thing was coming, and there were 56 specific warnings, including one titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S., he went on vacation. And, I mean, this is... I'm astounded. Dick Cheney goes on TV the other day and he says, should you have wiretapped American citizens in violation of the Constitution? He says, well, if we hadn't done that and this country had been hit, you guys would be saying, hey, how come you let the country be hit? How come you didn't track these guys down? How come you didn't, you know, wiretap the terrorists? How come you weren't on top of it? And I'm saying, yeah, how come you didn't?
Right, right. So is it you think we have a certain degree of criminally inept?
Yes.
I mean, is that the way to put it, then, I guess?
I don't think that they're inept. I think that they're very competent. I think that their competence has been directed in ways that have increased the authoritarian nature of our government to the detriment of civil rights and have not made us safer, but have made us less safe because more people in the world hate us, more... I mean, these guys, these guys who took these planes down did it with box cutters. You can still smuggle a box cutter onto an airplane. The thing that is preventing 9/11 from happening again is the fact that the airline cockpit doors have been hardened. And that was something that was proposed as legislation in the 70s when planes were being hijacked to Cuba. And it was fought by the Republicans because the airline industry said, we don't want to spend the money on it.
Yeah. And the pilots have always wanted it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they finally got it after 9/11. And everything else is just, you know, as the guy said on 60 Minutes a week or two ago, the rest of it's theater. It's a kabuki theater. I mean, here we are. We're patting down little old ladies and checking out the diapers of six-month-olds. And everybody goes, oh, yeah, I guess we're safe now. Nobody's going to take over an airplane again, but they're not going to take it over because you can't get through that cockpit door with anything short of a, you know, five-person battering ram.
As a personal anecdote, my father was actually one of the very first air marshals, what became the air marshal program. He was among the first group of guys called up by President Nixon to go sit on planes and ride around the world. And, you know, he was loaded down for bear. He had guns all over him just in case something happened, but I can remember growing up and him telling me, you know, they could have fixed this a long time ago if they just locked those doors, made steel doors. The pilots have always wanted that.
Yeah, and Israel did that, by the way. You know, El Al has always had hardened doors, and several of the other European airlines as well, particularly those that fly in and out of Israel. Swiss Air has had it for over 20 years. Those planes are not getting hijacked. They never have, and they never will. It's just, I don't know.
Tom Hartman is the host of the Tom Hartman Program, and you can hear it every afternoon, Monday through Friday, on our sister station here in Charlottesville, WVAX 1450 AM. Tom, we're going to break here at the bottom of the hour for a little local news and a little weather update. We got a nice storm coming in tomorrow morning. When we get back, we'll continue the conversation, but I'd like to preview it if we can. We'll talk about the middle class. I've heard you speaking on your program recently. You were talking about Charles Dickens and Scrooge, the small business owner, and the development of the middle class and unfettered capitalism actually does not create a middle class. And preview that if you can, and then we'll go to a break and explore it more when we get back.
Sure. I think because there has been a middle class in the United States for four generations since the 30s, most Americans think that a middle class is a normal thing. And they look at Europe and they see a middle class there and they think, oh, it must be a normal thing. It must be that if you just have a good capitalist system, you have a middle class. The fact of the matter is, a middle class is an abnormal thing. It is not a normal thing. And it is only created by one of three things, which we can talk about when we come back from the break. And two of those things we don't want to have happen here. And the third we do. So the bottom line is that the middle class in America is rapidly being wiped out and will be more aggressively wiped out unless we do something about it.
Tom Hartman, my guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now. More when we get back after this break for local news and weather. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
To flag our United States of America, to republic, which stands one nation under the God, indivisible, liberty, and only.
36 minutes after 5 o'clock in Central Virginia, I'm Coy Barefoot. This is Charlottesville Right Now. It's News Radio 1070, and it's WINA. Hope you had a great weekend. Happy Monday. Tomorrow on this program, Sean Kenny, former director of communications for the Republican Party of Virginia, will join us. And Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville tomorrow will count down the biggest development stories of 2008 here in Central Virginia. New neighborhoods, new shopping malls, new roads, you name it, he's got it. Tom Hartman is the host of the nationally syndicated radio program, the Tom Hartman Program, and you can hear that show every weekday afternoon, Monday through Friday, from 12 to 3 on our sister station, WVAX 1450 AM. I'm honored to have Tom Hartman on the program, and if you have a question or a comment, it's 977-1070. I know Tom would love to hear from you. Give us a call, 977-1070. Tom, let's talk about the middle class and capitalism. Because I heard you talking recently about Charles Dickens and Scrooge and capitalism, and it was just very, very interesting. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to repeat that for the listeners to this program, how a middle class is actually not a normal thing in the world of capitalism.
Right. It's not. And if you look through the entire history of capitalism, what you find is that middle classes actually very rarely emerge. What is normal is what Charles Dickens wrote about in A Christmas Carol, which, you know, many of us saw on TV or revisited this last Christmas season.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a very small, very wealthy class, which in British, in Victorian times when Dickens was writing, was basically the nobility, the lords and ladies and the royal family. You have a very small and modestly wealthy middle class, typically small business people, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. And Ebenezer Scrooge actually was the middle class of that time. He was a small businessman who owned a one-employee company. And then you have a very, very large class of the working poor, typically well over 90 to 95% of all the people. And that's how it was in Victorian England. That's how it was in the United States, in fact, in the late 1890s, 1870s through the 1890s. And that's the normal outcome of unregulated, laissez-faire, libertarian capitalism. And the only things that will change that balance are... And in fact, by the way, David Ricardo, the famous economist, really laid this out in 1816 in a series of two booklets. One was called On Labor, and the other was called On Profits, in which he pointed out in his book On Labor, what is referred to by economists now as Ricardo's Iron Law of Wages, that in an unregulated, laissez-faire capitalist economy, that the price of labor, assuming that the demand for labor and the supply of labor are relatively equal to each other, that the price of labor will always collapse down to that of a subsistence level. In other words, people will make enough money that they can survive, but no more, which is called the working poor.
And the only way to get ahead then would be credit.
Yeah, well, that's you're getting a little ahead of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
But so traditionally, what has happened there are three examples of a middle class emerging over the last 500 years in European and American history. The first was, or in the past 700 years, let's say, the first was in the what was it, the 1430s or 1340s? I mixed the numbers up when the Black Plague hit Europe, and about a third of the entire workforce of Europe died. And what that did was, you know, going back to Ricardo's Iron Law of Wages, it created a shortage of labor. So the demand for labor exceeded the supply, and so it drove the price of labor up. And as the price of labor went up, wages went up for working people, and a middle class emerged in the late 1300s. And the consequence of that was that people had enough time, because they weren't working 80, 90 hours a week. They had enough time for music. They had enough time for art.
The Renaissance.
Had time for literature. Exactly. Yeah. It was the Renaissance. That was the Renaissance. And then that kind of faded out and through the 1500s. And then in the mid-1500s, you know, in 1492, Columbus discovered America, as the story goes. But in the mid-1500s was when the conquistadors really started bringing enormous amounts of gold, mostly plundered from the Aztecs and the Mayans in Central and Southern America, back to Europe. And this explosion of wealth in Europe caused the balance between the amount of wealth there was, which caused people to want more things, the very wealthy, which created a demand for labor. Even though the supply of labor had not collapsed, you know, there wasn't a huge die-off of people, there was this increased demand for labor. And so, again, there was a second time when a middle class emerged. This was in the mid-1600s through the mid-1700s, about a 100-year period. And that period of time is referred to as the Enlightenment. And that was the second great middle class. And then that faded away by about 1830, about the time, arguably, the War of 1812 was the end of the Enlightenment. Here in the United States and in Europe. And we went back into this period of feudalism through the 1800s and right up until 1935, when Franklin Roosevelt saying, okay, we're going to create a middle class, but we're not going to do it by killing off a third of the workers, and we're not going to do it by plundering some other country and stealing their wealth because they're all pretty much gone. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we're going to do it by regulating capitalism. And the two main things that Roosevelt did, or arguably the three, the third was, you know, the social safety net that we talked about in the last half hour.
Right, right.
But the two main things that he did was, number one, he said, you can make up to $3.2 million a year in today's dollars. and pay a reasonable tax. You know, it slid from around 5% up to around 40%. But after you make $3.2 million, we're going to hit you with a 91% income tax. So, you know, most people didn't make over $3.2 million. So there were no dynasties emerging from the 1930s to the 1980s.
Very Jeffersonian.
Well, actually it was.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Jefferson was very concerned about the emergence of wealth that he said, you know, would be powerful enough to influence the state and thus damage the state. So number one, you had very high marginal tax rates on very wealthy people. And number two, he passed the Wagner Act in 1935, the National Labor Relations Act, which made it not just possible, but gave government protection to people who wanted to form a democracy in the workplace. Workplaces are essentially kingdoms. They're not democratic institutions. But a union is a democratic institution. It's elected by the workers. The leadership of the union is elected. They can't do anything. They can't vote on anything. They can't sign a contract without the majority of the members voting for it. And this gave labor power relative to management, and that produced the third golden age middle class, and that was from the 1930s to the mid-1980s in the United States. Our middle class started fading as Reagan came in and declared war on organized labor, at the same time that in Northern Europe, the Scandinavian countries, I did my show from Denmark for a week back in June, and it was amazing talking to people there. At the same time that they were actually, their middle class is getting stronger and stronger because they're giving more and more protections to labor and regulating capitalism.
We're talking with Tom Hartman, nationally syndicated radio talk show host. You can hear him every afternoon from 12 to 3 on WVAX 1450 AM, our sister station here in Central Virginia. Now, flesh that out for us, the development of the middle class from Roosevelt, you know, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and then we start to see changes then in the 80s, is your
right.
Thesis.
Yeah, what you find is that when taxes are relatively high on corporations and on very wealthy individuals, in the 1950s, for example, under Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, who thought this was a good thing and was outspoken about it, the average annual percentage of federal revenues that came from corporate taxes was around 35%. Right now it's 7%.
7% of federal revenues
is corporate taxes.
Is from corporate taxes.
Right. The majority of the rest of it, about 1% comes from tariffs, and the majority of the rest of it comes from personal taxes, and a good chunk of that from the middle class.
And is it so low because, well, you explain that, why it's so
low. It's so low because Reagan crashed corporate taxes.
Yeah.
Under the Eisenhower administration, you had very high, you had on people making over $3.2 million a year, you had a 91% tax rate, and on corporations, you had a 35% tax rate, and 35 to 50% tax rate. And so when Reagan came in, he, following this Lafler curve idea, you know, this kind of wacky idea that really doesn't make any sense on its face, but for some reason they all embraced it, because mostly the very wealthy people who fund the think tanks realized that they could get rich on this, and they have. Reagan blew this up, so if you look at the history of the United States all the way back to the beginning, what you find is that during those periods of relatively high taxation, you have strong, steady growth of the economy, like from the 30s to the 80s. It just chugged along. There were no huge bubbles. There were no huge crashes. It just chugs along. When you cut taxes dramatically, as was done by Reagan in the 1980s, and as was done again by George W. Bush, cutting back on the Clinton tax increase. When you cut taxes, then you get what appears to be really good times for a short period of time, but it in fact is a bubble, because all of a sudden the very wealthy people have a whole bunch of extra money and they're looking for places to stash it, and so things get bid up, and so you have this bubble, and then the bubble bursts and you have a crash. And whether it's the crash of 87, which was everybody thought was going to put us in the Great Depression, or it's the crash that's going on right now. And so, the crash of 87 following Reagan's tax cuts, this one following Bush's tax cuts. So very low tax rates are, it turns out, historically bad for an economy. And I realize nobody has been talking like this since the Eisenhower years, but, this is economic reality.
We're talking with Tom Hartman, nationally syndicated radio talk show host. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. Tell us where Barack Obama, President Obama, then fits into this continuum. What might we expect vis-a-vis your thesis?
Well, we don't know. And I was very disappointed over the weekend to hear that a third of the total stimulus package that he's putting forward is going to be tax cuts. Because for working people, generally, tax cuts don't matter. What you find, and again, look at the history of this country. You can just lay it on a line and watch it. When taxes on, you know, there's basically two kinds of people. There are people who spend 100% of their income, and there's people who spend, you know, much less than 100% of their income. Working people and the rich. And working people, people who spend 100% of their income, when their taxes go up, their wages will go up too, because their net after taxes has to typically remain the same. On the other hand, when they get a tax cut, their wages will go down. So, you know, for example, if I know, Coy, that let's say I'm your boss and you're making $50,000 a year, and after taxes you're making 30, and I know that you're willing to work for 30, whatever it is, you know, mowing lawns or whatever it could be. And so the government comes along and says, okay, we're going to give such a big tax cut that a $50,000 paycheck is now going to net $40,000. Now, I'm your employer. I know you'll work for 30, but now the paycheck that I'm writing for you is ending up at 40. What am I going to do? I'm going to cut your pay back down to 30. And if I can't do it, I'll find somebody else who will work for 30 and I'll lay you off. And that's exactly what's happened. When Reagan cut taxes on working people, wages went down. And when Bush cut taxes on working people, wages went down. On the other hand, if your taxes go up, working person, you know, so that I'm paying you $50,000, you're only making 30, the taxes go up, now you're only making 25, you're going to say, hey, I can't work for 25, this is crazy. And so I'll say, well, okay, I'll pay you 55 now, so you can make, you're back to 30, right? And again, when Clinton raised taxes on working people, what happened? Wages went up. There was a five-year period during the Clinton administration where wages actually went up on working people. Now, the equation is completely different for the rich. For the rich, when taxes go down, the amount of money that they get to keep dramatically increases because there's no relationship between what they need and what they're getting like there is with working people.
Right.
And when taxes go up, the amount that they end up with dramatically goes down. In just the last 4 years of the Bush administration, the Fortune 400 individuals, the 400 wealthiest individuals in America, went from a net worth of $600 billion to a net worth of $1.4 trillion. That's more than doubled because of the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts. So wealthy people do really well with tax cuts. But working people, because taxes were cut, working people's wages actually went down. And again, this seems counterintuitive because everybody's bought into the Reagan, you know, story about the economy. The fact of the matter is you've got a bunch of really rich people out there telling us how economy should work. You got the news commentators on TV. You had like David Gregory on NBC this weekend. You know, he's asking, you know, well, are you going to raise taxes on people? Well, you know, for somebody who makes millions of dollars a year as a TV commentator, that's a concern because it'll mean he'll have less money. For the guy running the camera, though, that's not a concern. And so it's like, people need to become economically literate in this country. And tragically, most of our politicians aren't, you know, even economically literate.
Yeah.
I'll bet that only one out of eight Democrats even understands what I'm talking about, and maybe one out of 300 Republicans.
It's interesting. It's as if the very poor have been made to think as if they're very rich and to vote that way.
That's right. And they vote that way. Yeah.
And they oftentimes vote against their own economic interests.
Almost always. Because they're getting, you know, it really started in the 60s when Joseph Coors and Richard Mellon Scaife and a few other very, very wealthy guys said, you know, we need to change the stories that we tell ourselves in this country about who we are and how things work. And they funded the Heritage Foundation and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the American Enterprise Institute and the Cato Institute and a whole bunch of these right-wing conservative and libertarian think tanks. And their main focus is economic. You know, they talk about things like gay marriage, but their main focus is economic. And it's really all about protecting the wealth of the millionaires and billionaires in this country.
We're talking with Tom Hartman, nationally syndicated radio talk show host. You can hear him Monday through Friday from 12 to 3 on WVAX, 1450 AM here in Charlottesville. Honored to have him here on the program. And the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Jim has been waiting patiently on the line. Jim, thank you so much for your call. You're on with Tom Hartman. Go right ahead.
Hello, Tom and Coy.
Hey,
it's a pleasure to be on with you.
Thank you.
Tom, I had a question regarding, I think his name was Thomas Malthus.
Yes, Thomas Malthus.
Okay,
his actual real name was Robert Thomas Malthus, but yeah, it was. History refers to him as Thomas Malthus.
Well, you know, he postulated that that perhaps the population would be better off if the surplus population just died off, and I'm wondering if you can see our society becoming, going back to that, to a point where the wealthy sort of govern, and they say, you know, too bad for you people who can't find jobs and can't find enough to eat. It's sort of like the survival of the fittest. I'm wondering if you can see our society ever going that way.
Well, I'd say we are going that way, and worldwide we're already there. You know, 3 out of 5 people in the world live on less than $5 a day. You know, fully 2 billion people on the planet don't have reliable access to safe water or sanitation, and that's you know, the population of the world in 1930 was 2 billion. You know, the population of the world in 1800 was only 1 billion. So, but Malthus's main contribution was he suggested that population grows logarithmically, you know, or let's see, numerically. What I'm forgetting my math terms, but it goes, you know, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. Population grows that way. And food supply only grows arithmetically, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So what would happen was that population would grow much more rapidly than food. Then it would hit a wall, and people would start dying off. Or they would start exporting them. I mean, one of the things that prevented a Malthusian meltdown in Victorian England was they started exporting people to Australia, millions of them, and to North America. Georgia was a penal colony here in the United States for the UK. And but, you know, the one thing that Malthus didn't – actually, he updated his thesis a number of times over about 2 decades – but the one thing that he hadn't considered in his original one was the effect of technology, the improving ability to produce food. And, you know, we've increased our ability to produce food, and so we've increased our ability to have more people. The problem is that we are now hitting a worldwide Malthusian limit. Rather than it just being confined to one country, we now have, with approaching 7 billion people on the planet, over 1 trillion pounds of human flesh on this planet. And we, as a single species, along with our food animals, and there's about 40 billion food animals on the Earth, we are consuming more than 50% of what's called the net productive capacity, the NPC of the planet, which is the product of all photosynthesis, and which means that every other species on Earth has to compete with us for the remaining 50%, whereas just 200 years ago, we were consuming about 3%. So our population is becoming a problem for the survival of life on this planet. And I think that that's the really big issue that we're going to have to confront.
Jim, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. And Tom Hartman, thank you so much for spending some time with us here on Charlottesville Right Now. Folks, you can catch Tom's program Monday through Friday from 12 to 3 on our sister station, WVAX 1450 AM. Tom, it truly is always an honor to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Coy, and it's always great to be on the show with you. You do a fine job.
Thank you very much. We're going to break for CBS News, local news, and weather here at the top of the hour. Best Seat in the House coming up in just a few moments. And tonight at 7, UVA Women's Basketball live at the John Paul Jones Arena. We have all the details for you, and Jay James is standing by to call that game for you. They are playing the St. Francis University. I don't want to say a bloodbath. We don't want to put the cart before the horse here, but UVA women are expected to do quite well tonight. So make sure you tune in and hear them hit the boards. Tomorrow on the program, we got Sean Kenny, the former director of communications for the Republican Party of Virginia, and Brian Wheeler will count down the biggest growth and development stories of 2008. This has been Charlottesville Right Now, News Radio 1070, WINA. Y'all have a great night. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.